Okay, very good. Okay, so let us continue where we left off. And now we're going to come to the famous lump of salt sutta, which says a lot about how we deal with karma in our lives. And this is a very useful way of thinking about karma. Many of you probably heard this simile before, but I think it's still useful to have another look at it regardless. So this is the next sutta, page 21 in your booklet. And, okay, so this is how it goes. Because if one were to say thus, a person experiences karma in precisely the same way that he created it, in such a case, there would be no living of the spiritual life and no opportunity would be seen for completely making an end of suffering. But if one were to say thus, when a person creates karma that is to be experienced in a particular way, he experiences its result precisely in that way, in such a case, the living of the spiritual life is possible and opportunity is seen for completely making an end of suffering. So I must admit, I don't feel this is very clear. When you read that, you wonder what exactly is going on, what the difference is between these two things. It seems almost to be the same. But the point here is that if you make some karma, right, you do a particular act, and then there is a precise equivalent in terms of how you have to experience it afterwards, then it is impossible to live the spiritual life, because we have made endless karma in the past. It all has to be experienced in exactly the way we created it. It means that there's endless ripening in the future. There's no end to it. And that creates a serious problem. What the Buddha is saying here is that when karma is experienced in a particular way, and this particular way usually means if you do bad karma, you experience it in a negative sense. You experience suffering as a consequence. If you make good karma, you experience happiness as a consequence, right? So this is the particular way that there is an bad karma always leads to suffering. Good karma always leads to happiness. But the amount of happiness that we experience and the amount of suffering we experience is not just about the karma that we make, but about all kinds of other things as well. And especially the overall kind of lifestyle we have, not just that particular event, not just that particular action that we do at a particular time. And this is what this lump of salt is about. And it's a very, very, very useful thing to keep in mind, because people are often afraid, oh, I've done a bad act. You know, do I have to experience the results of this badness? Or there's something bad happens in life. Think, oh, what have I done in the past, you know, that I have to experience this suffering now? And these kind of questions are really not very useful, because the question should rather be, what can I do from now on to ensure that these problems I don't recur in the future? And whatever results of the karma I have to experience, that they are at the minimum results from the karma I have done in the past. And if you think in this way about what you can do now, how to live now, how to ensure that things go better for the future, then you are really thinking about karma in the right way, rather than using it as some kind of just explanation for what is happening now. I think very often people want that, right? Something goes wrong in their life, and they want to understand why is this happening. And if you know, some monk can tell them, this is because you did this, right? You did this act in the past. Oh, thank you. That's very. And then they kind of feel relieved, because at least they sort of understand why they have to experience suffering, or whatever it is. If there is no explanation for suffering at all, if it's just random stuff that happens to you, it's even worse, right? Because then it kind of feels like the universe is just conspiring against you and making life really hard for you. And that is even worse. But actually, in the end, it is about how we live our life from now on that matters, not to explain things that happened in the past. When you've been born as a human being, you can expect a certain amount of suffering. Like we just saw before, black and white karma leading to black and white results. Black and white results means a certain amount of suffering. It just happens in human life. And that's usually why it's there, not usually related to anything specific necessarily from the past. And then the Buddha explains this in more detail. Here, because some person has created a trifling bad karma, yet it leads that person to hell. While some other person here has created exactly the same trifling karma, yet it is to be experienced in this very life, without even a slight residue being seen, much less abundant residue. Right, here's two people doing exactly the same thing. Say they steal something, right? They steal exactly the same amount. And yet, the result of that theft is enormously different depending on the mind state you have, the other past karma that you have done, and how you act from now on, and all of these kind of things. What kind of person creates trifling bad karma that leads him to hell? Here, some person is undeveloped in body, virtuous behavior, mind, and wisdom. He is limited and has a mean character. He dwells in suffering. When such a person creates trifling bad karma, it leads that person to hell. Right? So this is the kind of person. First of all, you haven't really practiced anything at all. You are undeveloped in body against sense restraint. You haven't really got your virtue together, much less the mind, the samadhi, and the wisdom, even less of that. You have a limited and mean character. Limited is paritta, like a small. You are small, right? Like a small mind. You don't have a big, expansive mind where you have compassion and metta for all beings, but you are limited inside of yourself. And it's quite interesting when you can almost feel the difference sometimes. If you are greedy, this feeling of greed feels kind of small. It's all about yourself, all about me, right? It's a small mind state. But sometimes when you feel really generous and you have a lot of metta and compassion for the world, it's as if your mind expands out and you can take in people from around you. You feel your mind is reaching out to the whole world around you. Right, so this idea of having a limited mind, a small mind, and this large mind which takes everybody else on board. And when you feel the difference between those two mind states, and if you observe that, then you know why greed is problematic, right? Because it gives you this kind of feeling of smallness and not really reaching out to other people. Okay. So you have a small and mean character, limited. The Pali word is appatuma, which means like a small self, right? A small self almost. And you dwell in suffering. So somebody who dwells in suffering at the same time, because you're suffering already, means that you probably have bad habits, you're doing things in the wrong way, thinking about the world in the wrong way. So because of all that, a tiny, small little mistake, right, can actually make you go to a very bad destination as a consequence. What kind of person creates exactly the same trifling bad karma and yet is to be experienced in this very life, without even a slight residue being seen, much less abundant residue? Here, some person is developed in body, developed in virtuous behavior, developed in mind, and developed in wisdom. He is unlimited, has a lofty character, and dwells without measure. When such a person creates exactly the same trifling bad karma, it is to be experienced in this very life, without even a slight residue being seen, much less abundant residue. So here you have the exact opposite kind of person who really has developed themselves, who is full of, you know, virtuous behavior, who has developed their mind, which means that they have some degree of samadhi even, and they have wisdom, right? All these wonderful qualities on the Buddhist path, and they're full of that. So you can see here is somebody who is possibly even an Arya or an Arahant. Somebody's gone a long, long way on the path. They have an unlimited and lofty character. And this is the kind of character you have when you develop metta and compassion. Right? We talk about unbounded metta, limitless, spreading out to the world, not leaving anyone out, even your worst enemy. Right? Actually, the point is that it's not. Sometimes we talk about doing metta and having metta to our enemies. But of course, the whole point is that if you do that, you don't really have any enemies in the first place. That is kind of the whole point. If somebody really is an enemy, you can't really have metta towards them, because enemy means you are thinking bad things about them, right? So you don't actually have any enemies. That's really the point. So you bring everybody in, your mind going out to the whole world, right? Having compassion and metta everywhere. This is really what these words mean here, the Appamana character, the measureless character here. And when you do that, Appamana Vihari, dwell without measure, is the last one there. Huh? When you do that, what happens? Well, you do a slight trifling bad karma, nothing too serious. Then you experience it in this very life. So maybe you feel a bit of guilt, you feel a bit of remorse, you feel a bit sad that you did that, right? And that way you experience a little bit in this life, but you don't experience very much at all. And it's all gone, nothing carries forward to your future life. It seems unfair, right? Here is this person who is doing exactly the same thing, and one person experiences so much suffering as a consequence, and somebody else experiences almost nothing at all. There are a few similes there which actually describe what is going on, and I'm not sure why I didn't actually include a couple of those similes. But one of them is like the difference between a very poor person and a rich person. And I guess it depends a little bit where you live in the world, but to some extent, it is true wherever you live. If you are a very poor person and you do a crime, right, the government will get you and they will whack you in jail and you have nothing you can say to anyone. But if you are really wealthy, you do exactly the same kind of crime. You just pay off a few people, right, or they think that you are powerful and that kind of stuff, right? And no worries, you're fine, no problems, no residue from that crime that you did. And this is how often things are. And it's a little bit like this everywhere. Of course, some countries are more corrupt than others. But I think it's always some truth to the fact that if you are more powerful, if you are more wealthy, generally speaking, you get let off more easily than people who are poor. And it's really unfair, right? But that is the way the world seems to work, it seems. And this is exactly the same with karma, right? Karma, it actually works in the same way, except that with karma, it is about your character rather than your wealth or your power and this kind of thing. Yeah. Okay. So what all of this means, now comes the kind of the simile which drives home the point, the simile of the lump of salt. Suppose a man would drop a lump of salt into a small bowl of water. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Would that lump of salt make that small quantity of water in the bowl salty and undrinkable? Yes, Bhante. For what reason? Because the water in the bowl is limited. Thus, that lump of salt would make it salty and undrinkable. But suppose a man would drop a lump of salt in the river Ganges. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Would that lump of salt make the river Ganges become salty and undrinkable? No, Bhante. For what reason? Because the river Ganges contains a large volume of water. Thus that lump of salt would not make it salty and undrinkable. Right? So the amount of water is the amount of good karma that you have made, in a sense. You have made this large mind, this enormous mind. And when you have put a little seed of something dark in there, it doesn't make that much difference in that beautiful, luminous mind. But if your mind is already small and there isn't much light in there, and you put a little bit of darkness inside, it really makes it even more dark and bad, in the same way as that lump of salt. So it shows us what we need to do, right? If we have made some bad karma, and everybody has probably made some bad karma, unless you are really, really goody-goody, saintly, saintly, but most people aren't that goody-goody, so... So for that reason, what we need to do is just to make heaps of good karma. And as we do that, every time we do an act of kindness, every time we think a kind thought, simple things, right? Nothing very fancy. Every time we do this, we are diluting the bad karma that we have done in the past. Isn't that great? It's all getting diluted. And eventually it kind of disappears completely because it's diluted down to almost nothing at all. And what a wonderful reason that is also for kind of doing good karma for ourselves. We are reducing not only the suffering here and now, but we are reducing future suffering as well in a massive way every time we do something good. So keep that in mind. It's another reason for living well. And then the Buddha just repeats what he has said before. In exactly the same way, when you make a trifling bad karma, it makes a big difference whether what kind of karma, what kind of character you have, it makes all the difference really. Okay, so that is the lump of salt, very famous simile. I'm sure many of you heard it before, but it's also very nice and very powerful simile, I think. So now what I want to do is go backwards. Go back to the gradual training, back to page 14, the shorter sutta on the simile of the elephant's footprint. And I want to have a look at the virtue section in the gradual training. And we have seen right view, we have then seen right intention, and now we come to right speech and right action, or right action and right speech, which comes next. And this is how it is defined in the gradual training. So somebody has gone forth, and having thus gone forth and possessing the bhikkhu's training and way of life, abandoning the killing of living beings, he abstains from killing living beings with rod and weapon laid aside. Conscientious, merciful, he abides compassionate to all living beings. Yeah, this looks a lot like the first precept, right? The first of the five precepts. No killing of any kind of living beings. But although it looks very similar to that, well, first of all, this is about the bhikkhu's life, training and way of life, which basically means the precepts to keep as a bhikkhu and the way you train, the way you practice. But what is interesting about this, and what is so, so important, I think, is that it's not just about not killing or not, you know, doing other bad things to living beings. It is about the exact opposite. It's about laying aside rod and weapon, right? And it is about being conscientious. Lajji is the Pali. The opposite is like being shameless, merciful, daya. You abide compassionate to all living beings. And this is this morality here, shows you morality in a much wider perspective than when all you do is read about the first precept. Reading about the first precept shows you what you're not supposed to do. And by the way, it's not just about not killing, right? If you think it's just about not killing, you might think, oh, torturing is okay as long as I don't kill. But it's not quite like that, right? It means you should not do anything harmful to other beings, of course. But the opposite side here is also made a very strong statement about in this case, that we should be compassionate, we should be conscientious, we should actually do the opposite, the positive thing of morality, not just avoid the bad things. We should deliberately go out of our way to do good things, to support others, to help them, to be compassionate towards them, and all of these kind of things. And there is an important difference between the two, because when you are avoiding just the killing and doing the bad stuff, it means that to a large extent you're avoiding having a sense of bad conscience and remorse afterwards. You don't feel bad about yourself because you're not doing the bad things. But by doing the good things, we're actually doing positive things that we feel really good about afterwards. You think about your virtue, you think about your sila, you sit down to meditate, right? And when you sit down to meditate, these impressions come back to you, and you feel good about yourself because you live well, you are kind and helpful and compassionate to people around you. And what this means is that we should try our very best to take every opportunity in our life. Whenever we have a small opportunity to do something kind and helpful, we should take that opportunity. Because by doing that, we are fulfilling this idea of virtue to a much, much greater extent. And then we are enabling the whole path to grow. Remember what we were seeing before, the idea that meditation is based and is founded on virtue, on sila, right? Because it is founded on that, and it means that the more we can do in the area of virtue, the more our meditation will take off and the more samadhi we will be able to have. So every little act matters. Every little thing we do, every little thought we have is important on this path, right? And as you think like that, this feeling of appamada arises in you. You start to feel heedful, careful. You feel, oh, I got to really take every opportunity, right? And you see a small opportunity to say something kind, to do something kind. Wow, you grab it and you do exactly that. And then your life really becomes a blessing for yourself and also for the people around you. Avoiding the bad, doing the good, taking every opportunity to do this kind, to do what is right in this world. And so that is one of the, I think, important points to take away from the way these things are expressed here. Often just keeping the five precepts. It's wonderful. I really praise people who keep the five precepts. If there's anyone you here who doesn't do that, I would recommend you to the absolute maximum. Please keep those five precepts, because it's going to be for so much happiness for yourself and also the people around you if you do that. So please do so. It's kind of the foundation stone of morality on the Buddhist path. But for those of you who are really committed on the Buddhist path, take it even further, right? Go one step more and then fulfill these teachings to even greater degree than just keeping these five precepts as they are here. So this is the, I think, one of the most important points here. But I would like to discuss just very briefly some of the other aspects of right action here as well. As we were looking at before this morning, we looked at this idea that karma is not just either good or bad. It's all kind of gray zones between good and bad. And this is true also with the way that we deal with other beings, right? Sometimes you come from this enormous sense of compassion and kindness. You just want to help the whole world. And it's very, very beautiful when that happens. And you know, then you are going to the very bright side of the spectrum of good actions. We're talking about bright and dark deeds. Now you're moving really towards the bright spectrum. Almost, your mind is almost entirely pure. And when you act on that beautiful, pure mind, the kind of karma you make is also very, very good and very positive. And then you have the karma when you are in a really dark space, right? Oh, you really hate somebody or whatever it is. Well, you feel really terrible when that happens. And then if you act on that kind of bad karma, it's the very, very dark. But most of the time, we are somewhere in between there, right? And this, I think, is such an important thing to remember. And this is why it is here stressed also again, why compassion is stressed here. Because compassion, of course, is what is the deciding factor for whether karma is on the bright side or on the dark side. And this is a very useful thing to recall in your life, because very often we are, you know, the reality of life is often very complex. You know, we have somebody in hospital who says, please turn off those machines. I've had enough. I don't want to keep on living. I'm going to die anyway in a couple of months' time or in a couple of weeks or whatever it is. I'm almost on the end. I don't want to keep on suffering like this. And then you ask yourself, what is the right thing to do in that position? Is it right to keep those machines going, maybe torture that person just because you are afraid of making a decision? Or is it better sometimes, if you have thought about it carefully, if you know that this person has been wanting this for a long time, you have considered this with wisdom in a wise way, is it maybe the right thing to say, okay, maybe it is time to switch off those machines? They only have a few days left anyway. The quality of life is virtually zero. Actually, probably negative at this particular point. What is the right thing to do? So you can see here what is going on here. What we are asking ourselves is, where am I coming from? What is the motivation that drives me to do this? One type of killing is terrible. Another one, when you help somebody in this way, it is a very, very different situation. There's a vast ocean of difference in between. And it all has to do with motivation. Where are we coming from? Why are we doing these kind of things? Yeah, so this is how we think about all of these ethical dilemmas. The way to think about any ethical dilemma is always to ask what the motivation is. There is no yes and no answer very often. It is a gray scale, and it all depends on the state of mind that you bring to that decision at that time. Of course, when we do things that are dilemmas, we have to be very careful. I'm not saying that you should make quick decisions in these situations. You have to be very careful, and you have to look inside of yourself. Only make decisions when you feel sure about it, right? When you feel relaxed, at ease, your mind is clear, you know what you're doing, then you can make these kind of decisions. And if you are unsure, better not to do it at all. But sometimes if it feels right, it feels you're coming from a good place, and then you cannot really go very wrong because the motivation is there. Nobody else can tell you whether what you're doing is right or wrong. Only you can know that for yourself. So this is, I find this so beautiful with the Buddha's teaching, that we have this flexibility, we have this broad understanding, ethics based on our inner state of mind, rather than some fixed rules that have been laid down. The vast majority of ethical systems are based on fixed rules. Buddhism actually is very different. Yes, we have the five precepts. Five precepts are incredibly useful because it gives you a very useful guide for how to live. But they are not the final account of how ethics works in the Buddhist teaching. Okay, so what I thought to do was to have a look at a couple of suttas that talk about this idea of compassion and kindness a little bit. And this is in how to deal with one's parents in particular. So now go forward again to page 22. Oh, we're making good inroads in these suttas. That's good. Otherwise, we would never come to an end. So, so page 22 now. And this is about one's parents. And in the Buddhist teaching, some of the most powerful karma that we can make towards our parents, right? It's one of those very important things in the Buddha's teachings. You may know that on the very first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, it says, it has this very strange little formula in there. It says, there is mother and father. Right? And what does that mean, the idea that there is mother and father? And what it really means, of course, that the whole beginning of right view is all about karma and rebirth. So this also refers to karma and rebirth specifically. So when we say that there is mother and father, it means that mother and father are a very powerful field of merit, or, if we may get it wrong, demerit for us. Right, and this is the very interesting thing, that mother and father are singled out in this way as very powerful fields of merit. It means that we can do a lot of good, both for ourselves and also for our parents, by getting this right and getting these things in a proper perspective. You know, one of the really bad things you can do, according to the suttas, is to kill your parents. It's one of those things that lead to immediate bad rebirth in a subsequent life, and it shows you. It's equivalent to the arahant, right? Killing an arahant or killing your parents has the same immediate karmic effect. And that shows you again what a powerful field there are for merit. And this is why when it comes to right action towards our parents is particularly important. And that's why I picked out a couple of suttas just to make that point a bit more clear. So, this is from the Anguttara Nikaya 2, Sutta 33, so you can check it out yourself later on if you wish. And this is how it goes. Because there are two persons that cannot easily be repaid. What two? One's mother and father. The first thing that is interesting here is that this is spoken to the monks, right? To the bhikkhus. So, in other words, it means that monks too have a kind of duty to their parents to look after them in the right way. Not just for lay people, but for everyone. And this is then what the Buddha has to say about this, about how difficult it is to repay your parents. Even if one should carry about one's mother on one shoulder and one's father on the other, and while doing so should have a lifespan of 100 years, live for 100 years, and if one should attend to them by anointing them with balms, by massaging, bathing, and rubbing their limbs, and they even void their urine and excrement right there, one still would not have done enough for one's parents, nor would one have repaid them. Even if one were to establish one's parents as the supreme lords and rulers over this great earth, abounding with the seven treasures, one still would not have done enough for one's parents, nor would one have repaid them. For what reason? Parents are of great help to their children. They bring them up, feed them, and show them the world. So it is almost as if you cannot, it's very hard to repay your parents, right, according to this. Even if you establish them as the kind of the king and the queen of the entire world, still you haven't really done enough according to this. And of course the point here is that your parents, without your parents, you wouldn't really be able to survive. Especially in the early years of your life, you're completely dependent on your parents for your survival. So in a very real way, they give you life in those first years. And of course, giving you life is then the kind of the basis upon which everything else is possible. Whereas establishing your parents as the supreme rulers of the world, well, you are giving them a lot, but you haven't really given them life as such. And this, I think, is kind of the distinction here. So they have really given you everything you've got comes from your parents in this way here. And then comes the way, interestingly, how we can repay our parents. But because if when parents lack faith, one encourages, settles and establishes them in faith. If when one's parents are immoral, one encourages, settles and establishes them in virtuous behavior. If when one's parents are miserly, one encourages, settles and establishes them in generosity. If when one's parents are wise, one encourages, settles and establishes them in wisdom. In such a way, one has done enough for one's parents, repaid them and done more than enough for them. Why? Because in this way you are establishing your parents not only in this life, but also for future lives, giving them an opportunity for vast amount of happiness and now and also in the future. So you are, in a sense, helping them for a very, very, very long term. And this is probably why you are repaying them by doing this. So this is really the trick, right? Of course, it is not easy to do this. It's not an easy thing to establish your parents in faith or to make your parents change their bad behavior. This is often a very hard thing to do. And especially if you go out determined to change them, then they are probably going to resist. They're going to say, go away, I don't want to listen to you. You are the child, I am the parent, you listen to me, I don't want to listen to you. This is often how it is with parents and family. It doesn't matter how old you get, your parents are still your parents, right? You become 50 and your parents kind of treating you still as a child a little bit. And this is why, very often, what we have to do, the way to change, the way to bring change about in the parents, as I said before, is very often through the power of example. When we change, when we truly become more compassionate, when we truly show that there is, the Dhamma actually works, it has transformed me. Right, look at me. I am this youth who used to be so rebellious, and now I'm actually being sort of kind to you, right? Things have, obviously something must have worked. And this is when people really start to listen, because they actually see something happening here. And so this is very, very powerful. And sometimes you can't really change your parents, but that's okay. You just do what you have to do. You live your life well anyway, because living your life well is always its own rewards. And if you do that, you're maximizing the chances that you'll also be able to help the people around you. We should never really have our hopes too high that we can help others. It's difficult enough to help ourselves. So if we can help ourselves, great. If a few other people are inspired at the same time, wonderful. But don't have too high hopes about those things. Usually what happens in life is that those people we want to change, they will not change. But sometimes there will be other people around who change, right? Who watch you, who see what is going on, and who feel inspired by your wonderful example. There's always people out there who feel inspired by us if we do the right thing and we live in the right way. So there's always this kind of, you know, things kind of expanding out. And that is so wonderful. So remember that, right? Even if you don't know about it, the effects are there in the world when you live your life well. So that is the first little sutta. I'm going to have a look at the second one, which expands on this a little bit more, also about parents. This sutta is from the Anguttara 3, number 31. It's called Brahma. So it goes as follows. Actually, that's interesting, isn't it? Because according to this sutta, Brahma is a designation for your mother and father, right? Now, my name is Brahmali, and it means that you are in the family of Brahma, right? That's what it means, the lineage of Brahma. So, right there, it must mean my parents really are Brahma. Wow, that's very interesting. I'll tell my parents that they'll be very pleased to hear that when I go back. You are like Brahma, mother and father. Oh, really? Okay. Okay, anyway, so this is how it goes. Because those families dwell with Brahma, where at home the mother and father are revered by their children. Those families dwell with the first teachers, where at home mother and father are revered or respected by their children. Those families dwell with the gift-worthy, where at home the mother and father are respected or revered by their children. Brahma Bhikkhus is a designation for mother and father. First teachers is a designation for mother and father. Gift-worthy is a designation for mother and father. For what reason? Mother and father are helpful to their children. They raise them, nurture them, and show them the world. So here, Brahma is a designation for mother and father. What does that mean? And of course, what it means is that Brahma, in the Buddhist teachings and also in other teachings like Hinduism, these are the gods that live in the Brahma Viharas, right? Who have metta, who have compassion, who have mudita, the sympathetic joy, and all these kind of things. These are the people who have endless kind of love, endless kind of kindness. So what we're seeing here, we're comparing the parents to these gods that have all, you know, endless love for the beings around them. And the mother and father are a bit like that. Right? This is one of those strange things. The last person to give up on the children are usually the parents. Even when they see their children doing all kind of crazy things, usually parents will be able to forgive their child. Right? Even my mother forgave me when I was a young scallywag running around doing crazy things. Actually, I wasn't that bad. Actually, I wasn't terrible. But we all do some bad things in life, right? That's usually the way it goes. And it's one of those remarkable things that mothers are usually able to forgive you almost no matter what you do. And why is that? What is the reason why a mother can do that? Remember, according to the Metta Sutta, you're supposed to be like the way the mother treats her only child, right? So why is it that the mother has this ability to do something special, to see that child in a different way? What is actually going on there? There's something to be learned from this, something very powerful. How can we have metta towards everyone, just like a mother has to her only child? It's a very powerful lesson right there. And the answer, of course, is that when the mother, she sees that child from it is a small little baby, very innocent, right, completely dependent on the support of the parents, and then growing up, and when the child is young, they have all these kind of sweet little qualities of young children, and see all the good qualities as that child grows up. And because the mother will always have that memory of the good qualities in her son or in her daughter, and because of that, she will always remember that, and because she remembers that, she will always be able to forgive, always be able to look at the bigger picture of the character of that person and not focus only on those negative qualities. Right? And it's exactly the same thing that we should do. We should remember that almost all the beings around us, especially people here at BGF, right? So many good qualities. And it's true. It's not just a joke. There are so many good qualities. People don't come here unless they have good qualities. What would be the point of coming to BGF if you were a real dodgy character, right? There'd be no point whatsoever. It's bound to be lots of good qualities there. At the very least, you are really keen on trying to live well. So remember this. When we look at other people, look for those good qualities. They are there, right? Remember, see those good qualities. And when you see that big picture and you see the good qualities in other people, then it becomes easy to forgive those little things that we sometimes do with each other. The little arguments we have, the little disagreements, the little unwholesomeness, whatever it is. We can let that go because the big picture is beautiful. And this is why we deal with
other people in exactly the same way as a mother deals with her child. And it's very inspiring, very uplifting, and very beautiful way of thinking about other people. And in fact, the interesting thing, of course, is that it is not just a kind of a theoretical thing. It is very likely to be a lot of truth in this. And the reason that there is a lot of truth in this, as we saw in the previous sutta about going around in samsara, crying more tears than in the four oceans, one of the corollaries of that, that the Buddha also talks about elsewhere, that whenever you meet somebody in this life, it is very likely that they will have been your mother at some stage. They will have been your father at some stage. They will have been your son, your daughter, whatever it is. So when we remember that, you know, every one of you here probably have been a relation of mine, and you have been a relation of each other and everybody else on this planet, right? It changes the way we look at things. The only reason why we are close to our family in this life is because we happen to grow up with them. But we have had similar kind of relationships with everyone else as well. So for this reason, we should really be able to forgive each other. We should be able to see each other as our children and our parents in a kind of respective fashion, just like that. So using the skillful ways of thinking like that, we can actually change our perspective on people, look at people in new ways. And as we do that, we can let go of all of these negative traits. It's very interesting that so much of the Dhamma is to learn to perceive and look at people, look at the world in the right way. And as we look at people and the world in the right way, that is how good qualities tend to arise. Simple little things, right? I mean, it's really so simple, and yet nobody does it, because nobody understands how easy it actually is to live spiritually well. The reason why it is hard, because as our character traits and our habits are so ingrained. But if you keep on doing these kind of things, keep on listening to these kind of discourses, doing it again and again and again, you are going to grow, you're going to change, and gradually you will see things in this way. Right? It's kind of inspiring, isn't it? It's really nice when you think about these things in the right way. And of course, when it comes to our parents, it is especially important to remember that they have had that love for us. They probably still have that love for us. And when you remember that, you are able to forgive all those little things that happen in family relationships. Because we are close together, your parents are not always going to show their love to you. Sometimes they show their love to you very rarely. But still, there is that thing in there whereby they want your best and they want to support you. And just by remembering that, bringing that to the fourth, you can forgive the little problems, forgive all those other things, and focus on the big picture. And then, instead of your parents becoming a burden in your life, I know that sometimes people, especially in parts of Asia, this idea of filial piety, and people say, oh, so much burden, I have to look after my parents so much, and oh, all of these things. But if you think like that, you are wasting the opportunity, right? Instead of thinking like that, you should think, my parents really have supported me. Now is my turn to do the right thing back. And learn to look at your parents in such a way that it becomes easy, much easier anyway, to look after them. By thinking about them in the right way, it becomes so much easier to do what is right. Often, we think that quantity is very important. We have to be around them all the time. But quantity is not necessarily the most important. The quality is often far more important than quantity. So more important to not see your parents every day, or even call them every day, or even maybe more important to give them that quality when you are there with them and when you support them and when they really do need you for whatever reason. So this is just a way of learning to change our perception, change away from seeing things as a burden and seeing them instead as a possibility for growth, for improvement in the Dhamma practice. Right, and the next one is about seeing your parents as your first teachers. And this is just to remind yourself how much your parents have done for you. Right? All those things that we have learned from our parents from when we were small. They have taught us all the most basic things in life have been taught by our parents. They teach us how to dress. They teach us how to go to the toilet. They teach us how to brush our teeth, how to eat the right thing, how to kind of walk, right? We wouldn't even be walking probably without our parents. We'd be crawling on the ground or something. All of these things that our parents teach us, often with endless patience, because it takes often a long time before we learn these things. They teach us how to speak, how to pronounce things properly. They teach us how to function in the world, how to deal with family members and people outside, how to be polite, how to be respectful. All the basic little things in life we learn from our parents. They are by far our most important teachers. Okay, the Buddha is pretty important as well, right? But our parents give us the basics. The Buddha gives us the higher teachings afterwards. So again, remember that, right? When you think of your parents in that way, you start to realize how much they actually have given you and how impossible your life would be without your parents being there and supporting you in this way. Your first teacher, your most important teachers are your parents. And then the last one, the idea that your parents are gift-worthy. Usually in the suttas, the gift-worthy people, they are the Aryas, right? Exactly. So, but here it is your parents who are said to be the gift-worthy. And in a sense, what the Buddha is doing here, he's putting your parents, in a sense, on the same level as the noble ones in the world. In the same way that you can do very bad karma by killing your parents, just like killing an arahant, in the same way you can do very good karma by treating your parents in the right way. So here, gift-worthy. They're worthy of support, of gifts, of all that positive action, the compassion and kindness that you're talking about just before. So again, a very beautiful way that this is described right here. That is just a little bit about our parents, because it is one of those things that is important in the suttas, and it's one of those things that I think is important to get right. Don't make looking after your parents a burden. Think about it in such a way that it becomes something positive in your life, something that supports you in your practice. Try to find that middle way whereby it works for you. Right? Then it becomes right. Then it becomes a very positive thing. And a lot of that is just about perceiving it in the right way. And as you do that, it enables you to do these things properly. And for those of you who have parents who have passed away, I'm sure that is a few of you, for that is the case also, then remember that you can also still do good things for your parents by thinking about them, this thing we call sharing merit with them, whatever it is, do these little things after they passed away, and then hopefully they will be able, because they're close to you, they will be able to receive some of that goodwill coming from you, and that hopefully help them in wherever they are in the destination after death. Okay, so we are dealing with right action, so let us get back to right action again. Back to page 14. Okay, so we have just looked at the first precept about not killing and about being compassionate to all beings. And now we come to the second precept, if you like. Of course, here it is not precept. Here is just part of Samma Kammanta, right action on the Noble Eightfold Path. Abandoning the taking of what is not given. He abstains from taking what is not given. Taking only what is given. Expecting only what is given. By not stealing, he abides in purity. So here we have this idea of not stealing, right? One of the little things here, expecting only what is given. Actually, what it probably means is that you don't actually even have the thought of taking what is not given, right? Even the idea of that doesn't really occur to you, that you should steal. So it has this idea of mental purity as well, is kind of part of this. And interesting, it says that by not stealing, you abide in purity. So theft kind of leaves this kind of taste of being impure afterwards. And that is what you are avoiding here. So again, remember what I was saying before, is that stealing as well, or taking as well, has a large number of different degrees to it, right? It is not just that stealing is all the same. It really depends a lot on the kind of situation you are in. And sometimes, in extreme situations, in a kind of situation I like to kind of think about is, imagine a parent, a mother or father with a small child, and for some reason they are in great poverty, great difficulties, the government doesn't support them, nobody supports them, and then you decide maybe to steal something to support your little child, right? And maybe you even think that when I have the means, when I have the money later on, I will repay that person who I'm taking from her. Yeah, that is a very, very different situation. If you steal something simply because you are incredibly greedy and you want something that somebody else has, these are very different mind states. And because they are very different mind states, the karmic consequences are also enormously different in those two situations. So remember this, gray scales, right? There is no absolutes here. One is absolutely right, another is absolutely wrong. It's always best to avoid stealing if you can, but try not to be too judgmental about these things, because if we do, it's more important to look here at the intention and the motivation that lies behind these kind of acts. Then we can understand what is going on. And also, as with the previous type of right action, here also we are dealing with the difference between, on the one hand, the negative side of morality, which is to avoid stealing, and the positive side of morality, which is the opposite of stealing. What is that? Generosity, right? When you steal, you are greedy, you are taking something for yourself. When you're generous, you're the opposite of greedy. You're giving of yourself, relinquishing things freely. And that is really the opposite side of stealing. The reason why generosity is not mentioned here in the path, I think, it's because generosity itself is often singled out as a separate factor in the practice. Very often you will find, when you see the what is called the graduated discourse that the Buddha sometimes gives to people, he starts off by talking about generosity, right? Generosity, then virtue, then renunciation, and then a kind of achievement of the insights and the samadhi, that kind of stuff later on. But the very foundation there is generosity. So generosity is a very powerful tool in the Buddhist practice. And if you use generosity wisely in your life, you will find that there is something beautiful happening there, where you are kind of expanding your consciousness out to other people. You're kind of taking others on board. You're having more compassion for the world. Sometimes you may feel this sense, this urge of sharing with others, this urge of being generous. And when you feel that inside of yourself, you can see what a beautiful feeling it is to be truly generous. And then you understand that it's not just the other people who are benefiting from your generosity. You are benefiting enormously as well, because it just makes you feel so happy, makes you feel so good inside. It's almost as if you take the whole world into your heart and open to everyone. And it's a wonderful feeling when you can experience these kind of things. And it says in the sutta that if you are going to be able to enter a state of samadhi, or you're going to be able to become a stream enter, the only way you can do that is by having this open-hearted feeling, open-handed, where you are freely generous, freely sharing and giving with the people around you. No holding back, no greed, no sense of miserliness, right? I'm not going to share with others. Completely open-hearted to the whole world. That kind of mind state is the mind state you need to have to be able to enter into samadhi experiences. So this gives you some feeling for what samadhi is like. It's a very beautiful state of mind. And when you come out of samadhi afterwards, of course, that those qualities are strengthened even further as a consequence. So that is generosity for you. I want to have a look at a few suttas on generosity as well, because the Buddha has a lot of beautiful things to say about this. But let's have a break first of all, and we come back to this in about 15 minutes time. So see you again at 3:15 here.